Hi, everyone. I'm hope everyone's having a great day. And I'm, well, it's the holiday season, so I'm sure a lot of you are very stressed right now, and I understand that. First, I want to say thank you to everyone who came out to my Cineprop show. We're returning in January. More with that as we get closer, but I really want to thank you guys this year for supporting me, and it's been fantastic. Second, support us on iTunes. We have a couple new podcasts coming out soon, so download us and listen to back episodes. I really want to break a big round number we're getting close to by the end of the year, so that's exciting. And then in the next year, we have some exciting new things, so stick to the Facebook groups and follow us on Twitter, because exciting things are on the way. Well, and without further ado, let's start one of the more controversial Christmas movies, only mainly because people like to argue whether or not it's actually a Christmas movie, but, you know, it's fun, so enjoy Die Hard.
Hey guys, are you looking for a new podcast to listen to? Something a little on the geeky side, but lots and lots of fun with some crazy dudes? Well, have I got something for you. It's called the Vitamin Geek Podcast. I'm the host, Corey Keelan, and I'm here with my friends, Eric Williams.
What's up?
Patrick Sykes.
Greetings, everyone.
And Michael Zippy Miller.
Hey there.
We're going to talk about all kinds of stuff. Horror movies, science fiction. We love Star Wars. Who doesn't love Star Wars? If you don't like Star Wars, get the hell off of here. Check us out, man. Vitamin Geek Podcast, right here on the ESO Network.
It's all part of the plan.
Welcome to Miami Defender Childhood. This week, we watched 1989. I didn't check.
88, I believe.
88's Die Hard, the first one. Because there's, what, six of these now? And
there's five, and they go in descending order.
Wait, okay, so there's Die Hard, Die Hard 2, Die Hard with a Vengeance.
Mm-hmm, then Live Free or Die Hard, and then that one in Russia that everybody's already forgotten.
Die Hard in Russia.
I think it's a good day to die hard, but who cares?
Yeah, that's it. God, that's a bad movie.
I have a box set that I got for like $20 that has all five of them, and I got it because it's the only way to get the unrated fourth movie. But I have never watched the fifth one. I never want to.
I think I watched the fourth one in theaters, and it was crap.
I watched it in theaters. I liked it, but only because my expectations were so low.
Well, it's hard to have high expectations anymore with these movies. Oh, I mean, yeah. Bruce Willis doesn't even show up anymore.
No, he doesn't.
I mean, and he shows up for this one, of course, and so did Alan Rickman and everyone involved. It was a fun movie. Mm-hmm. This is also the cokiest, most conservative cliche movie ever, but whatever. We'll get into it. So I'm Nick Hoffman, editor of Dude Letter and host of My Infinite Childhood and Riff on Cineprov and whatever. And you are...
Hello, I'm Daniel, and I frequently walk on glass barefoot.
Oh, my God, that scene. Oh, you know it's coming.
Oh, I know.
And you know it's going to happen, and it's just, oh, it's the roughest thing as he's dragging his bloody feet into the bathroom. Oh, gross.
Oh, those were good practical effects. I mean, I actually believe Bruce Willis had cut his feet for the sake of cinema.
Oh, so much. Was this before or after Moonlighting?
I looked it up. It was right in the middle of Moonlighting, and actually he would like shoot this at night and then go back during the day to shoot Moonlighting and then come back to shoot Die Hard.
What? You mean they shot this whole movie at night? I never would have guessed. I mean, because he was the biggest thing. Like, Moonlighting was a smash. I'm too young to remember it because this was when I was two.
I've looked up clips at points, and the only thing I remember is Bruce Willis in a scene talking like Dr. Seuss, and that's my only exposure to Moonlighting.
That's funny. I mean, because he really is charming as hell in this.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, and he doesn't do, like, this is what made him huge, right? Because, I mean, right, Moonlighting was out.
But it's really hard in the 80s. It's funny, now we take for granted that good TV means good actors, which means good movies.
Mm-hmm.
But back then, like, to make that leap was actually pretty rare.
It's still kind of rare. I mean, can you think of anybody who's made that leap from TV to movies?
No one that has the ego, right? Because, mm-hmm. like, you don't get, like, a Tom Cruise type anymore because they have an ego where they don't do crap projects. But someone like Bryan Cranston can make the leap because he treats acting like a job.
Yeah. Well, he's been in a whole bunch of stuff even beyond his TV roles. He was already established at that point. So.
And again, he's just someone who shows up and does a good job. In
your movie. Yeah.
You know, the only ones I can think of are comedians who can make that jump. You know, your Will Ferrell types, your Adam mm-hmm. Sandler types, who I don't care for Adam Sandler anymore, but that's where he started. He was a TV guy.
Yeah. SNL back in the day.
And such. I mean, even John Lithgow is someone who did everything always, so he's kind of hard to pick.
Well, that was even funny because Bruce Willis in Moonlighting was a comedic actor, and here he is being the exact opposite.
Well, so really quick, we're going to recommend this movie. You're going to recommend this movie.
Oh, fucking A, man.
Yippee-ki-yay. I'm going to recommend it too. Subsequently, I assume this is one of those movies that everyone has seen. Like 100%. Everyone, and if you haven't seen it,
it's on FX this Christmas. Go watch it.
It's guaranteed to be on TV this Christmas. And it's so famous, it's so well done, and it's so enjoyable that even the dubbing over the profanity is well known. One of the best lines ever written to film is Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker, which, in fact, a very English Alan Rickman playing a German guy says back to him at the very end, Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker.
Actually, I think people misuse that line these days, including the Die Hard sequels. It wasn't meant to be a triumphant line. It was meant to be John McClane, not Bruce Willis, John McClane's character pretending like he was fully in control and essentially acting out a Western hero.
Right, because he said he was Gary Cooper or something?
I think he said he was partial to Roy Rogers.
Right, that's exactly right. But, you know, and so he says it in a very Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker, kind of way. Yeah. He doesn't say it like, yee-haw. This isn't him writing the A-bomb down in Dr. Strangelove.
Which he does in the sequels, which kind of ruins it.
Yeah. So that being said, we're both going to recommend it, which means we'll stick to the original format of the podcast, but we're just going to dick around because this is, because it's like, this is more of a Zach action film, but Zach couldn't be bothered because he's Zach. And if you've noticed with the podcast, he often just can't be bothered.
Oh,
hey,
Zach's a fun dude when he wants to be,
but he just doesn't show up to this. So regardless, we're going to talk about Bruno Radalini or whatever the fuck his fake name is.
Bruce Willis?
That's the one he plays music under. He's Bruno and the Return
of Bruno. Oh, yeah. Jesus Christ. I'd forgotten about that until now.
Here's a trivia for you.
Yeah?
Okay, so of course he did Die Hard. And then was on Moonlighting Until It Ends. Then he does Die Hard 2.
Mm-hmm.
He is in a big movie between Die Hard and Die Hard 2. Do you know what it is?
I would assume Bonfire of the Vanities, that huge bomb that Brian De Palma directed and ruined his career.
That came out after that.
Oh.
It came out, in fact, after Die Hard 2 and the sequel to the movie I'm talking about.
Oh, geez.
He was the voice of Mikey in Look Who's Talking.
That's right. Oh, my God. Yes.
And then Die Hard 2 and then Look Who's Talking 2.
Oh, my God. Yes.
And then, like you said, Bonfire of the Vanities. And that had so much weight that he got to make his passion project, Hudson Hawk.
Yeah.
Where he sings in it. And on the soundtrack, Bruno has 3 tracks.
I've seen maybe 10 minutes of Look Who's Talking in my life. And it was Bruce Willis... just pretty much, they shot a baby and they did it in one take because it's a baby. They can't do retakes. And then they got Bruce Willis to improv over whatever the baby was doing. And it was just so horrible.
Yeah. And wasn't it Christy Alley who gets knocked up? And
it was
George Siegel is like the dad.
No, John Travolta was the dad.
No. I think John Travolta is the guy who is dating her.
Ah, well, like later. I said, I've only seen 10 minutes of it. So
it might be a stay tuned. It's a bizarre movie.
Oh, boy.
But yeah, so Mikey is one of like 12 bald babies and possibly bald Bruce Willis at one point. And Bruce Willis is the voice.
I remember on Cartoon Network back in the day, they used to have this thing on Saturdays called Cartoon Theater. And that's where I first saw Wallace and Gromit for the first time.
Yeah.
But they had this one like
very early 3D animated movie. It was like right after Toy Story. Was it
Food Fight?
No, this was way back in the day. It had Bruce Willis in it, and it was like, I think they used the Bruno name.
No shit. Bruno the Kid?
That was it. That was it. Oh, my God. That was it.
It also had a TV show, too.
Ugh. Oh, Jesus.
Bruno the Kid, the animated movie.
Yeah, that was it.
Apparently, his career died. God, can you look at this? It's amazing how far his pendulum swings, because he did North. The year he did, North came out the same year as Color of Night and Pulp Fiction.
How did he survive Color of Night and North? Pulp Fiction, I understand.
I mean, but I have no answers. He did Nobody's Fool, which I've never heard of. He had four major movies in 94, followed by Die Hard with a Vengeance.
Well, let's be honest. He had one major movie in 94 and then a bunch of flops.
That's true. And then 95, he has Die Hard with a Vengeance and 12 Monkeys in the same year.
Ooh, that was a good year.
Yeah. And then Last Man Standing, Beavis and Butthead Do America, and Bruno the Kid is 96.
Oh, that's right. He was the guy that hired Beavis and Butthead to kill his wife, right? And his wife in the movie was Demi Moore.
That's exactly right. And then in 97, he had The Fifth Element.
Mm.
And what's the actress who plays The Fifth Element?
Mila Jovovich?
Mila Jovovich. Her character is the Beta for 11, right? The woman who can't speak English that has all the powers.
And,
and then he appears as Bruce Willis on Mad About You. So there.
Oh, there you go.
I mean, it's just funny because
you remember when Mad About You was halfway regarded as a good TV show?
Paul Reiser sure does. Every day he wakes
and
up.
And Helen Hunt, who's even got less of a career now than Paul Reiser.
The problem is she doesn't try anymore. She can step away. He's desperate for anything. He had a sitcom on NBC that lasted one episode.
I watched 5 minutes of it while waiting for The Office to come on, and it was a disaster. And Larry David was the guest star. And it's like, what are you doing, Larry David? This is worse than when you were on Hannah Montana. Come on, Larry.
Larry David, man. His last SNL was pretty rough.
I didn't watch it.
You're not wrong. God, and then his career just keeps going, man. He was in Mercury Rising, The Jackal, Fifth Element, or that's a video game, Armageddon the same year.
Well, he got sued by Disney at one point because he quit a movie that they were doing, and then he basically said, I'll do three movies for you for way below my salary if you don't sue the hell out of me. One of them was The Sixth Sense, so there you go.
Yeah, it was The Sixth Sense, The Kid, and The Whole Nine Yards, is that right? No,
I think it was The Sixth Sense, The Kid, and Armageddon.
Oh, that might make sense, yeah, because that was Touchdown.
So obviously Bruce Willis made a huge impact on our childhood because he was just everywhere in the 90s.
Well, and the thing is, when he tries, he can act. That's why so much of his shit is frustrating, because when he doesn't act, he's dead on screen.
I remember when he was in Sin City, and that was the whole thing that Frank Miller was saying back before we realized that Frank Miller was crazy, is that he called Bruce Willis the modern-day Humphrey Bogart, and it actually made sense.
Yeah, it does. That's actually a really good way to put it, because like, you watch him in something like Sixth Sense, he's acting like, and I mean, you said Sin City is great. Meanwhile, what was that Kevin Smith movie he did? Cop Out?
Oh, yeah.
That, like, he's they're practically dragging him across that screen.
Oh, he did not want to be there.
Well, and I mean, if you guys have ever listened to a podcast Kevin Smith does, he brings this shit up, but because Kevin Smith is someone else who doesn't have a career anymore. But
hey, Kevin Smith's got a great podcasting career.
And that reality TV show Comic Book Men.
And he directs like a bunch of superhero TV shows now.
Yeah.
Stay tuned. We should do a Kevin Smith.
Yeah, we haven't done one yet. And I don't know. Well, we can talk about it off mic what the first one will be. We haven't even gotten the plot of this movie.
Okay, yeah, I'll go ahead and get into that if you'd like.
Please.
So there's a cop in New York named John McClane, and that's Bruce Willis. And his wife is named Holly, and she took a job at the Nakatomi Corporation in California because she thought it would further her career. So she invites John out for a Christmas party that they're doing. While they're at the Christmas party, the Nakatomi building gets invaded by these pseudo-terrorists who actually just want to steal a bunch of bearer bonds from the vault, and John is trapped there. So while they're there, John uses his street New York cop wise smarts trademark to thwart the terrorist attack.
So why this movie works and why it doesn't. We talk about shitty movies all the time. We talk about good movies actually a lot. This one works because you never feel like he's fully in control.
It works because of Bruce Willis, frankly. I mean, he always acts, especially in the first act, he's a very scared person who wants nothing more than to get help.
And this is a new style of movie. Like, we don't really talk film theory a lot, but since it's Daniel and I guess we can a little bit. This is a kind of movie that had never existed before. And now is ripped off by everyone.
Mm. Oh, in the 90s, it was always like Speed, for example, is Die Hard on a bus.
And Under Siege is Die Hard on a boat.
Air Force One is Die Hard on Air Force One.
Yeah. I mean, like, and that's what it is. Speed 2 is also Die Hard on a boat.
We don't talk about Speed 2.
I mean, that is a stay tuned if there's ever been a stay tuned.
Oh, Jesus.
But I mean, and that's kind of what it is, to the point where even, like, we were talking about it, this is one of the first movies to do Bond better than Bond is doing Bond.
Especially at the time, yeah.
Because this is, you know, I mean, and we've done all the Bond movies, but, like, Tim Dalton did two of them. One was in this era, right? This is right between License to Kill and Living Daylights. And, frankly, this is the better movie.
Well, I think what people forget these days, especially the younger folks out there, you goddamn kids, get off my lawn,
yeah,
is that in the 90s, well, everyone these days, every action star is basically a superhero.
Yeah.
In a literal sense. I mean, they're all playing Marvel comics. And back in the day, that just was not a thing that happened. It was all these four or five manly men who would come out with a movie maybe once every 2 years. And that was as big of an event back in the day as the Marvel movies are now.
Well, and like the only comparison, the only proxy we really have nowadays, I mean, yes, you're right, is the Marvel movies. But the Marvel movies are about the characters. The closest thing we have nowadays is Tom Cruise, and he's really the only one of these guys who survived the 80s.
Like, yeah, pretty much.
I mean, and it's because he carries the charisma throughout. Like Schwarzenegger, Stallone, Willis, they have zero charisma outside of their characters, and you can tell when they don't want to do movies.
Yeah.
I mean, which is why those Expendables movies are a fun idea, and some of them are better than others, but like it's just getting the old gang back together.
Chuck Norris and Jean-Claude Van Damme in those movies are great.
Well, I mean, and Jet Li, because they're the people who want to be there.
Yeah, they care.
And the first one, everyone shows up, and then it's just like, Kelsey Grammer is like, would you like to be a bad guy in an action movie? Fuck yeah, I want to do anything. Hell yeah, I want to work.
I need to pay for my top shelf liquor.
I mean, he's Fraser Crane to me all the time.
Well, I mean, one of the best things about Die Hard is back in the day, this was Bruce Willis when he had just come off a sitcom. So everybody, like, the fact that he could be an action star was a joke.
Yeah, no, it's true.
Back in the day. And he does it, but he does it by being a very scared man who would act like any of us would in that sort of situation.
And like, the only thing he's good at is the fake confidence to make it keep going. But mm-hmm. other than that, you know, I guess the bravest thing he does is think that his hair looks okay.
Yeah, this was back when Bruce Willis had hair.
Kind of.
It was like all of 6 years or so.
But I mean, like, again, I mean, just think of the guys who we were talking about in those movies before. Like, it's Die Hard, but on a blank, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That's the game you can play. Like, Wesley Snipes in Passenger 57 or Steven Seagal in Under Siege. Like, same kind of thing. They're just rugged guys with strong jaws. That's all. I mean, JCVD mm-hmm. you mentioned, which, what would his be? Sudden Death?
Yeah, probably, or Bloodsport or Blood Hard Target or any one of the... Time Cop. Time Cop's probably the quintessential JCVD.
Oh, God. But I mean, but like the Die Hardest movie is probably.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay. Or Executive Decision. Oh, God.
Well, the other thing that really works about this movie, if I can go ahead and change course, is Alan Rickman. This was his first movie, believe it or not. And I know when he passed away, my reaction was, I want to throw a German off a tall office building. Oh, but he's so actually a very charismatic villain in this. And. You're constantly guessing, like, what his motivations are, especially in the first act, because, again, he acts like a traditional terrorist, and he's mocking the owner of Nakatomi, but he's not. He's just a dumbass crook.
Yeah, I mean, and, like, the thing is, you're confused because it's Alan Rickman and he's wearing a good suit and he has some clever lines.
Oh, what do you think of that bit where he's like basically flirting with Takage, the guy who owns the building, and he's like going, "Nice suit. It was from this shop in London, and I have to myself."
Well, and was it Gaddafi who shot? So
yeah, Arafat. Rumor has it Arafat buys his there.
Your German accent is so good.
No, it's not.
It's so good. But yeah, no.
That's why you tune into this podcast, for the good German accents.
Yeah, right. Yeah, from the... Oh, God.
Rumor has it that Arafat buys his dare.
That was my Werner Herzog shopping for suits.
I was watching, what's the documentary he has on Netflix? Into the Inferno?
Oh, he's got a bunch.
Oh, no, I mean one he made for Netflix about volcanoes.
Oh, yeah, Into the Inferno, yeah.
And I was just listening to him do his narration. I was like, I would listen to him do a Subway sandwich.
The Inferno is the biggest burst of the planet. It reminds the humans that the planet is what is in control.
Well, I mean, it was just, I was thinking about it and I was listening to him and I was just imagining him talking about Subway sandwiches, which is like the sandwich artist takes the breads out of the oven, which is warm like a womb.
The 6-inch is only half the satisfaction that the customer craves. In fact, they want the foot long, which no longer costs the $5, but it costs a little more, but the consumer is willing to pay for it.
You know, I wasn't thinking about it from that side. I thought I was imagining him narrating an instructional video like those PSAs about cell phones. But I do imagine him thinking, do I want to biggie size? Biggie sizing is more of the calories, but I am very hungry.
There is a hunger that I cannot satisfy without the biggie size.
All right. So... Alan Rickman is playing a German guy. I mean, that's what it kind of boils down to. It's a plot to steal, you know, $680 million of bearer bonds.
Something, yeah.
Which is hidden by the Nakatomi Corporation.
Well, it wasn't hidden, and it just sort of was there. I mean, I think it was based on a novel, which people forget, and I actually...
read it and own it.
I didn't read it. I looked up certain YouTube videos that explained it, and originally it was supposed to be something that they gained through fraudulent means, but in the movie, it's just sort of there.
Yeah, it doesn't make a lot of sense, but whatever, who cares? That's not why we're here, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, and it's funny because it's the cliche now, but it's really... We want to get blank. Why not get blank? Hell, we have blank, right? I mean, and that's why those... Speed might do it the best where there's a reason.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part,
Speed's by far the best Die Hard knockoff.
Yeah, probably. But I'm just thinking about it. Like, I'm trying to think of why they're doing it in Under Siege. Like, in Speed 2, mm-hmm. It's because the guy wants revenge. But revenge is fine.
Now, I'd like to ask you about the action, like, directing in this. Because this is still considered... And I actually read a list of the top 100 action films recently. It was in some British magazine. Sure. Not Empire, but the other one.
The other one.
And Die Hard was, like, number one. And I'd like to ask you about that, because watching it again, it's like, I kind of get it, because it's all practical effects. It's very quick cutting. It's very frightening when it needs to be. What did you think of all that?
I like it because it feels like there's stakes. I mean, there are occasionally, like, for example, the first Rambo movie, it feels like there's stakes. Like, but like, you know, we were talking about Pierce Brosnan as James Bond earlier, because sometimes we just talk about Bond, who'd have guessed. But, you know, like, by The World Is Not Enough, he's just slightly moving his head out of the way while bullets are flying around him. Mm-hmm. There's no threat, none at all. So here, the fact that he crawls across glass, man, like barefoot glass, that feels like there's real stakes. Mm-hmm. It feels like he gets the crap beaten out of him. So you feel invested. That's it. Long and short of it, you feel invested.
I also think that the scenes with him with Reginald Val Johnson, I forget the character's name offhand.
Powell,
yeah. I mean, originally in the film, Powell gets introduced by buying Twinkies at a convenience store, and then they
call him to check out Nakatomi Plaza, and a body falls on his car, and that's why he's there. But all that dialogue between him and Bruce Willis was great because it humanized John McClane.
Yeah. Well, and he's the only one who listens, right? Like, what's his name? Paul Gleason shows up as the, like, the hard apple detective.
Oh, and then the FBI shows up that makes Paul Gleason look like a genius.
Well, and it's one of these things, too, where it's, again, it's like an 80s conservative movie. Like, the individual is stronger than the cops, the FBI, the government's all wrong. The media is wrong.
Yeah.
Literally everyone in is wrong, well, except for the individuals.
The media is dickless from Ghostbusters.
It is dickless from Ghostbusters, and he always plays a great asshole.
I think he'd be probably pissed off if you ever refer to him as dickless in public, so don't do that.
What's the actor's name? Do you remember?
Will Atherton is his name.
Oh, that's Will Atherton. Yeah, that's right. And he's good. I mean...
he's great in this movie.
But I mean, like, he shows up at the house, which tells the terrorist, like, who the kids are and stuff. And
who and John McClane's wife is, because originally she's going by her maiden name, so they didn't guess.
Right. And so we have this whole scenario that's essentially unfolding. Like, I mean, and what is it? It's John McClane happens to be in a back room changing... Mm-hmm. When the terrorists take over. So he has a quick advantage. But, you know, his cop sense takes over. And when the guns start flying, he's hiding. That's it. Like, and he's behind the eight ball. He just happens to get a walkie-talkie. So he sounds like he is like the kind of ghost haunting the building.
Well, originally, and this is great, when he kills the first villain in the movie, it's this very drawn-out fight where the only reason he wins is because they both tumble down the stairs and the terrorist breaks his neck, which leads to the now I have a machine gun ho-ho-ho bit.
Yeah.
But, I mean, nowadays that would be like a cliched commonplace where that was done in 2 minutes. But in this case, it was done because McClane was trying to pretend he was stronger than he was.
Yeah.
And that's why he gets the walkie-talkie and his machine gun and everything. But at the same time, it just works so much better here.
Well, and it just shows that he's in charge. And like you said, it's directed in a way where he is slowly gaining control. But it's him acting that he's confident, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And frankly, the only one he talks to that kind of gets, who kind of understands it, is Val Johnson on the ground.
Powell. Yeah. What do you think now about that whole backstory where Powell shot a kid who was holding a toy ray gun? I mean, that to me read a lot differently now than it did probably back in the day.
Yeah, it's something he has to get over. I don't know. It's something that would have definitely made more of an impact nowadays.
That's what I mean. I mean, we've seen where instances like that happen, and it's not... Even with Powell, it's not something that just people get over.
Well, and the point of it then is that he needs to get back on the horse and start shooting again.
Yeah. Spoiler, that's the ending, basically.
Yeah. I also like how there's no resolution, right? Like, what's his name? Atherton wants to be like... No, not Atherton. Yeah, Atherton. No, Gleason. Gleason wants to get him to be like, oh, you know, you need to speak for blah, blah, blah. You killed this guy and this guy, and you did, you know, you blew up half the building, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You have someone to answer for. And then he just walks off into the distance. He cuts
Oh, yeah, that's right. Well, if I recall correctly, what happens is the Val Johnson's chief tries to place him under arrest, and that one living terrorist, Carl, I think,
yeah,
comes back, and then Val Johnson shoots him, so it was a big interruption thing.
And then he just gets him back out of that limo, which has been in the basement since the beginning of the movie.
Well, with Argyle, I mean, Argyle's the best.
Argyle,
man,
is a great character.
You know, that was the kid in Blues Brothers who was trying to shoplift from Ray Charles's store.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Damn kids. And he shoots.
Breaks my heart.
Oh, man. This might be the first director where we do his entire filmography.
Well, what? There's Predator. There's this.
Hunt for Red October. Last Action Hero. Die Hard with a Vengeance. 13th Warrior. Thomas Crown Affair.
Do we have to do 13th Warrior?
He also did the 2002 Rollerball. You want to talk about an unnecessary remake? He did that Sean Connery movie, Medicine Man, too.
Wasn't he in prison for a while because he got caught up in that one Private Eye scandal?
Oh, yeah, no. He did a movie called Basic in 2003 and then hasn't done anything since, but he's out of prison now, and he has a movie coming out next year.
Jesus.
Yeah. The announced John McTiernan project.
Jeez.
Untitled John McTiernan project. Written by Philip Shaw. Well, there you go. That Rollerball movie is such a disappointment.
I've seen the original. I haven't seen the remake. I remember when the remake was getting advertised, and then it came out, and then everybody was like, back in the day before Rotten Tomatoes, kids, you really had to depend on word of mouth and the local paper, and they were not good.
Well, and you had to have a reviewer you liked. You know,
Yeah.
I liked the our local paper here is AJC, and then when I was in college, I would read the Inquirer, Cincinnati Inquirer. The Times, if I gave a shit, but the Times report, who's the guy at the Times? Is it Shales?
A.O. Scott?
Scott. Scott is good, but he can be real pretentious, especially when I just want to watch action.
Oh yeah.
But you know, I was always an Ebert guy, so.
Yeah.
R.I.P.D. Anyway.
Are you suggesting? I know, but are you suggesting Jeff Bridges and Ryan Reynolds are going to come after him in a very bad way?
I don't know. I've read some of his reviews of some Ryan Reynolds movies. He might.
Well, that was back in the day when Ryan Reynolds was a joke. I mean, Van Wilder was out, and I've read his review of Van Wilder, and I kind of agree with him. That was a bad movie.
To be fair, I've read his review of North, speaking of movies.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
That's a classic. Mm-hmm. I hated this movie. Hated this movie. I hated this movie.
Hated every audience-insulting minute of it, I think.
Oh, man. I almost want to do a... We should do it as a reading of a slam poetry if we ever do it.
There you go. We've barely talked about Die Hard so far, so if you don't mind, I'd like to talk about a scene that I thought really worked well today, which is the initial scene where the terrorists come in and are taking over the building, especially that bit where the computer expert like is describing a basketball game to Carl, and then they kill the security guard.
Yeah.
Yeah, you remember that bit.
I will say that computer guy is interesting. They dress him up as...
Isn't he the only one to live?
Yeah, we don't see anything what happens to him, so I think he gets out.
He is in the van, the getaway van, and Argyle runs into it, and that's the last I remember him being in.
So he must, okay. He's dressed up like the guy with the flip up glasses from a different world.
Yeah.
But that's who he is. You know, he's the nerdy computer type. He's the one who breaks through 7 of the locks. And like, it's funny because again, we know what's happening that no one else does. The FBI and the cops are actually helping the terrorists the whole time.
Well, that's how it works at the end of the day, because especially on the ground, the whole theme of this movie is that you need a true grit, which ties back into the whole Western thing. From the people that are actually there as opposed to the people on the ground who are going to do it by the book, damn it. I mean, this really does create that whole you need to do it by the book cliche, that and Lethal Weapon, I think, which is by the same producer. Silver. Plug for my spinoff there, because Silver crossed over into that.
Well, and I mean, this is such a Joel Silver piece. Like, you should almost watch this at 1.5 speed, or 125% speed, because you'll get the amount of cocaine that he must have been taking. Like... And you can tell the moments when they're like, all right, Joel, you can give input here and not here. Because, like, it is bloody and it's violent and it's on top, but it still feels like a reasonable amount of blood. And then there's sometimes when they're just boobs for no reason.
You know what I miss? Squibs.
Yes.
I mean, today they have nothing but digital blood that they've clearly put in and post, and they do it because they think, oh, well, if we don't do it, then we'll get a certain rating. But, oh, man, squibs, which is like this little makeup effect that simulated a gunshot where blood would fly out, those are great.
Well, and when you're watching even like old like horror movies where it's just a condom filled with corn syrup and red food coloring, it still has weight. Like the actor knows where he's been shot. And so he reacts, as opposed to a lot of this, or like a lot of modern stuff where like Stallone has been shot 6 times and there's fake blood everywhere, but he doesn't know where he's been, where they're going to add later. Yeah. So he doesn't really act to that.
He lunges back and that's about it.
Yeah. Other than that, I mean, there's my favorite scene I just want to throw out there is when Bruce Willis is on the roof, he runs into... Alan Rickman, who realizes he doesn't know who I actually am, so he puts on an American accent and pretends to be a guy who just wandered away from the Christmas party.
Oh, Bill Clay, right? That was his fake name?
Yeah, and it's something that was on the wall, so he figures it all out. Mm-hmm. Whatever. It's just, it's great. He tries to get the drop on McClane, and McClane is just a bit faster. Mm-hmm. But like you said, it's interesting because these aren't world-class terrorists. They're bank robbers, effectively.
Yeah.
Which is the joke. Like, it's something that they even mentioned. He goes, all this is just for a bank robbery. All this is just for money.
Yeah.
Which is, whatever. It's cool. It's very well done.
This was back in the day where terrorism was still a thing, but it was pre-9/11, so it was sort of a mild nuisance as opposed to a global threat. That's sort of the mindset you have to have going into this movie.
Well, and that's what William Atherton says when he's doing one of his sleazeball reports. He's like, you know, L.A. can now put itself in the list of the world cities, like Moscow and blah, 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 as we have now been the victim of a major terrorist attack. Mm-hmm. But no one says terrorism. The press does, right? Again, the press is kind of the bad guys here, mm-hmm. which is...
Well, Takagi says it when Alan Rickman takes him out to the boardroom and then kills him. He's like, what kind of terrorist are you?
Well, and that's just it. And then there's this... God, what's his name? Ellis, a sleazeball type, is like, I'll negotiate with him.
I was so glad when Ellis got killed.
Yeah.
Well, he was like calling Alan Rickman Booby, and I'm like, Booby, dude, what the hell?
Yeah, man. He's treating it like a negotiation, and he doesn't realize that Rickman holds literally all the cards.
Reagan's America. Obviously, the American businessman would be on top, damn it.
Yeah, and that's literally the joke.
Yeah.
I'm surprised there wasn't coke in this movie. Like, literally someone...
Doesn't Ellis take
Ellis
coke?
Ellis does take a bump of coke.
He does take a bump at some point.
This also might be the most 80s movie ever done, except for the outfits, who look reasonable.
Yeah.
It's this in a Hughes movie. This in 16 Candles.
Jesus.
That's funny.
Stay tuned for John Hughes. I mean, that was a little after my childhood, but I think it might cross over into a couple people here. Oh,
but I mean, but even still, like, Hughes movies, like Breakfast Club was on TBS all the time.
I remember Ferris Bueller being on TBS.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Often. Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, even still, like, I learned of him pretty early on. And he's generally the kind of person that my parents weren't uncomfortable watching the movies either. Mm-hmm. You know, he had a little wheelhouse. Whatever, he doesn't matter anymore.
Who, John Hughes?
Oh, I mean, he's been
dead for a while. I still think he matters.
Well, fair, but I mean, like, his kinds of movies aren't being made the same way anymore.
That's true.
His movies are still classics.
Well, they're not really making Die Hard movies anymore like they did back in the day. It's always, it's become comic book movies with superheroes.
Well, I was going to say, and the people who aren't are still superheroes, like John Wick, for example. Especially the first John Wick movie is a really fun movie, but there's never a chance that he's going to be the one hurt.
I always thought the hotel that he was staying at had a more interesting backstory than the John Wick character.
But, I mean, to be fair, it's not unlike this movie where the plot doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It's just that he is the great... But the problem is that he's the greatest shot ever. Possibly the best movies that are done for action right now are the latter Mission Impossible movies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, like, they're overall competent. They care about their plot.
You know what was great recently was Atomic Blonde. That came out this year.
Yeah.
Great action movie. I think it's better than John Wick. And only because, even though Charlize Theron's character was kind of a superhero, there were still stakes in it where that she might not succeed.
Yeah.
In her mission.
I agree. And it's got an aesthetic, which I like.
Mm-hmm. An 80s aesthetic, which is rather ironic.
It's totally appropriate. I mean, because I like Theron's look because, frankly, I mean, and it's the reason I like Keanu Reeves' look. He's not Stallone, where he's so inflated he doesn't look like he can move.
Yeah.
Both of them look like people. Or Drive, or, you know, like, where there's a certain amount of, like, intensity, but it's not...
Well, still Hollywood people. I mean, they're still better looking than 99% of the people out there, except for us, of course.
Oh, yeah,
we look better than that.
I look exactly like I sound, which is probably 5.5 feet tall and all nose. Anyway, you guys need to see this movie if you haven't, so let's give away the ending. After crawling through glass, he's injured. But the FBI's on the way, and they have gunships. And McClane realizes that there's something weird. Hans Gruber, Rickman's character, who I don't know if we mentioned, kept trying to get to the roof. Why would he go to the roof?
Because it's on fire, literally.
Yeah.
And Alan Rickman does not need no water. He's going to let that motherfucker burn.
He's covered the whole roof in C4 explosive.
Right. That was another plot point, which is at one point John McClane ends up with the detonators, but doesn't know what they're for, and Hans Gruber's trying to get them back.
Yeah. The terrorists kind of put all the hostages on the roof. McClane desperately tries to get him off by firing, so the cops think he's the bad guy.
Well, originally, and feel free to correct me, I think their idea was that they had asked for getaway helicopters as part of their terrorist attack to take them to the airport, and the FBI was going to ambush them, but Hans Gruber was going to blow up the roof to make it seem like everybody, including him, had been killed so he could escape with the money easily.
Right, because the whole idea was you rob a bank, they look for you the rest of your life unless they think you're dead. Right. And he's got bearer bonds, which means whoever's holding the bonds owns them, right? Like it's not like a bank account transfer where you have to use the GoldenEye satellite to erase all records to prove that you never stole it.
Right.
Which is the stupidest part of that movie. But that's the general idea. So McClane, after rescuing all the people, is desperately trying to get to Gruber, but at this point Gruber realizes who his wife is. And so they have a good old-fashioned standoff.
Yep. Right?
I mean, that's pretty much it. McClane is down to, he throws his gun away, puts his hands up in a scene that you've now seen 100 times because everyone rips this off.
Well, they were ripping it off from old Westerns, really.
Oh, no, this is, it's not the Few Dollars one, which is the best Western ever made. Is this 310 to Yuma? Whatever. It's a classic scene where essentially he puts his hands up. He has taped to his back another sidearm. Mm-hmm. He shoots Gruber in the face and the last German guy in the face. His wife falls.
Well, he's holding on to his wife's Rolex, which is apparently a year-end award that Nakatomi had given her for her great work throughout the year. So, you know, it's kind of symbolic, I guess, where her hubris was being punished.
Yeah. Staying by your man and stay home, I guess, is the whole point.
Reagan's America.
And Gruber's not hitting the head. He's hitting the shoulder or something. At which point, holding on, he slips and falls to his death. To which I believe Gleason says, I hope that's not one of the hostages.
That's right.
And that's it. And then you have the romance scene when Willis gets out of the building and he sees Powell and he's like, Powell? And he mouths out,
that's right.
It's a cute scene. They're a cute couple. They win cutest couple. I love Jean Valjean. It's funny that all he's known for is being a cop in everything. Yeah. He's even a jailer in Ghostbusters.
Well, this and Family Matters were like his two biggest things, right?
Well, and I mean, I think he's in a bunch of stuff where he's just a cop, whatever. But it's just, he's perfect in this role, man.
Did you call him Jean Valjeanson?
Reginald Valjean.
Reginald.
Jean Valjean is from Les Mis.
Yeah, I was about to say, that's the weirdest Les Mis remake in history.
That's really funny. Jean Valjeanson. Did I do that? All right. God damn, that's really funny. All right, we're out of time. Let's wrap this up, man. Because he apparently played a judge a couple times too, including on Oh, It's Sunny, which I knew. But
oh,
I liked him so much in this movie.
Oh, he was great in this movie.
Because he's the one who has to deal with shit. Like, I mean, yes, Bruce Willis is the one who is fighting the terrorists. But on the ground, like, everyone's making every wrong decision. And he's like, guys.
Well, he's human to a certain degree, too, because he's talking about his pregnant wife and having to pick up Twinkies for her. And I know about a year and a half ago, you and your former producer went through that. So I can only imagine how real that seemed to you.
I mean, it's one of these things, too, where he's literally doing his job, doing it fine, and gets thrown into this, and then he's the only one who's right, and no one wants to listen to him.
Oh, when I say former producer, I mean his wife. I don't want to make it sound like that was a scandal.
And it tore apart our podcast. All seven of our listeners were on the edge of their seats. Anyway, but yeah, man, I told you at the beginning we were going to be all over the place because we like this movie, so we're just going to talk about it. But yeah, you're down, right? Like, this is...
Oh, this is an amazing movie.
Does it count as a Christmas movie? Because that's something...
Oh, that's the thing that everybody debates. I don't know if anything really counts as a Christmas movie, especially if you're just talking about in terms of set during that time period, because that just covers a lot of stuff, really.
Well, because here's the thing for me. This time of year, since this is going to come out, I believe, the 7th, it's all, like, syrupy sweet stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's Santa Claus and a bunch of stuff. It's a lot of animated classics. Fine. This is your palate cleanser. Like, everyone loves this movie because it's an excuse to watch something that's Christmas-ish. In that, it's just like watching Honor Majesty's Secret Service, which is also set during Christmas.
That's very true. It's A Wonderful Life is set during Christmas, but it doesn't really include Christmas themes.
It's a suicide movie.
Yeah, basically.
I mean, and so, like, I like this as a palate cleanser, and it's a fucking fun movie, man. It's you don't get... Oh. This is probably the most fun movie other than possibly Commando or The Rock that we've done.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, there's a reason that everybody back in the day was ripping this movie off and failing at it, because it was so much fun and it was so stylish and it has such great characters. I mean, and nobody does it right anymore.
And nobody does it better. This is... It just... And it is, honestly, for what it is, it couldn't be more fun.
I see what you did there just then.
We've made enough Bond references. I'm utterly charmed by this movie, and I'm charmed by Bruce Willis in a way that, frankly, it's a shame that he doesn't do more charmingly. And we have another movie of his coming up on the docket in a few months. And Bruce Willis. And it's just...
Which movie? Do you want to go and spoil that? Or?
Yeah, because it's coming up far enough in advance that no one will remember, but we're doing The Fifth Element.
Oh, yeah, that one. That was...
Well,
that
and he gets to be put upon one. Again by people like Chris Tucker, who he just cannot deal with in that movie.
Oh man. Rudy Rod? It was that DJ. That's a classic character, man.
Anyway, but we do get to have a hint for next movie, I guess. I'm trying to think of how to put this. If I had thought, I would have let Daniel do some of this. But let me see. We have a Christmas movie coming up, and this one is, I guess, one of the few Christmas movies that we will all agree is a Christmas movie that is also a horror movie, but written by a perennial Christmas movie maker, Chris Columbus.
I know Chris Columbus. Like his namesake, he brings pain, suffering, and disease wherever he goes. I hope this is better.
So stay tuned, and tune in next week and every future week when we put a piece of your past on trial. Thanks, guys.
Oh, the weather outside is frightful, but the fire is so delightful. And since we've no place to go,
Lyopi Defender Childhood is a member of the ESO Network and produced by Dude Letter Podcasting. It is hosted by Nick Hoffman. It is edited by Nick Hoffman and Candace Burns. The theme song is Caroline by the Serenaders, and their music is available on Amazon. Please rate and review us on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcast. And tune in next week when we put another little piece of your past on trial. Thanks.
But if you really hold me tight,